was a delightful dirty trick. You know, we philosophers ask questions like, what can you be certain of? And there's not too many things you can be absolutely certain of, but when you're married to an Italian, you can be certain you're married. When we were courting, our favorite movie back in the 60s was Divorce Italian Style. It was an Italian comedy about a guy who wanted to kill his wife because that's the only way you can get a divorce in Italy. There was no divorce in the 50s in Italy, so he hired a mafia hitman to try to kill his wife, and the hitman killed every other woman in the apartment building, but the wife survived. But what was so funny about it was that since we're both Catholic and we're so totally opposite, we knew it was going to be a crazy marriage. So we said, you know, that movie's right. Murder is more rational than divorce. And divorce is a stupid, divorce does not exist, divorce is a myth. That door does not exist, we're safe. As long as we don't have any lethal weapons in the house, we're safe. So. Oh boy, you ask an absent-minded professor of philosophy to talk to practical doctors who save lives. Okay, here you go. Why be pro-life? Well, we're living in a culture of death. That's the strongest reason, but the phrase pro-life is positive, not negative. Anti-abortion is, of course, a consequence of pro-life. If you're pro-life, you're anti-death. But the only reason for any negative is the positive. All the Ten Commandments are stated negatively, but they exist for the sake of something positive, for protection. And if there's no right to life, there's no right to anything. We all know that. I'm not gonna tell you much that's new tonight. There is indeed a seamless garment of pro-life issues, because wherever life is threatened, we're there defending it. Especially today, abortion and assisted suicide. The news, by the way, is half good and half bad. The new generations are more and more pro-life when it comes to abortion, and less pro-life when it comes to euthanasia and assisted suicide. This positive, seamless garment of life does not necessarily mean that you have to be a pacifist, or that there's no right to self-defense, or that capital punishment is intrinsically wrong. I think it's a stupid thing to do because we don't need it. But in primitive societies where dangerous people will kill innocents unless they're disposed of, the state has the right to capital punishment, according to the Catechism of the Catholic Church. The Catechism also says, in most modern societies, there's no need to exercise that right. The seamless garment is like a suit. Not all parts of it are equally important. Abortion is at the heart of it. It's not a hem, it's a heart. If anybody says to you, abortion is a complex issue, you can be sure that they're pro-choice. Everybody who's pro-life knows that it is not a complex issue. As Mother Teresa says, if abortion isn't wrong, nothing's wrong. If the victims of abortion aren't human, then none of us are human. We're all former fetuses. And if the victim of abortion isn't innocent, then nobody's innocent. It's just about the clearest and simplest issue in the world. And therefore, we've got a great advantage, because everybody knows that. There's a thing called conscience, universal human conscience, natural law. Paul says so in Romans. Even the pagans know what's right and wrong. So when we talk to pro-life people, pro-choice people, We're talking to two people. We're talking to a mask, and we're talking to the real person. We're talking to the brain, and we're talking to the heart. We're talking to what comes up on the screen, and we're talking to what comes in the hardware. And when we do that, we should not confuse the two. And we should not merely talk to the person's lips, we should talk to the person's heart. Because when we tell them, you know better than that. You are not stupid. You know that what is in you is a little innocent human being. And you know that this is a terrible thing to do, and your conscience is going to bother you afterwards, and you will regret it, as 75% of all post-abortion women do. Not that we should lay a guilt trip on them. I'm not saying what you should say, but I'm saying that you should talk to the person behind the mask, because he's really there. Because the human heart was not designed in Harvard or Hollywood, it was designed in heaven. There are some things you can't not know. You just can't rip up your moral motherboard. You can just suppress it. So we use that. But you can also talk to the brain. The brain alone won't convince many people if they don't want to be convinced. Freud is quite profoundly right about one thing. Most of us, most of the time, believe most of the things we believe because we want to, not because we're convinced by evidence. The passions are stronger than the reason most of the time. But the reason is a powerful sensor. The reason is a powerful, but on the other hand, we can plant doubts. And in our culture of death, that's a strong weapon, because we are the barbarians at the gates. We used to be the establishment. We're not anymore. That's good. It's much more fun to play offense than defense in any sport, including culture. But the supreme seamless garment is not so much a seamless garment of issues about different threats to human life. The supreme seamless garment, I think, is the relation between the head and the heart. You have to use both, you have to appeal to both, you have to use both words and deeds, you have to use the two-bladed scissors to cut the paper. What we are and what we say, both words and deeds. The last three popes have been all very good about that. Saintly in their words, saintly in their deeds. John Paul II and Benedict were geniuses. They were also holy. Francis is a little Saint Francis. Holy, but he's not stupid. Except maybe on airplanes a little bit. So what can I, as a mere absent-minded professor, tell you? Well, not something that you don't know already, but maybe I can clarify the reasons for being pro-life. The most powerful reason, I think, is the direct appeal to intuition. We all know that. We all know the value of life. But there's also the power of argument. Faith is not, in the first place, usually a matter of argument. When people argue their way into a faith, when people use argument, it's usually after the faith appeals. I remember, I'll tell you more about this tomorrow morning if you're there. I remember when I first considered becoming a Catholic, my first reasons were intuitive. My goodness, look at this church. The closer you look at it, the more beautiful it looks. It's not true. Maybe it's not even good, but it's terribly beautiful. Probably the first Catholic thought I ever had was in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. I'd never been in a cathedral before, and it was the most beautiful thing I ever saw. And I was about 8 years old. I asked my father, Dad, this is a Catholic church, isn't it? He said, yes. I said, the Catholics are wrong, aren't they? He said, yes, they're terribly wrong. And I said, well, then how come their churches are so beautiful? And for the first time in my life, I saw my father confused. Well, that wasn't enough by itself to get me very far, but that shows how the first thing that strikes our consciousness about anything is it beautiful or ugly? The immediate intuitive response. You can't argue with beauty. That's why music is so powerful. You can't argue with music. But you also need reasons. So let me give you some reasons. I think there are four basic reasons for being pro-life. Purely philosophical reasons, purely logical reasons. The first one is the standard pro-life argument. It has three premises and one conclusion. There is, first of all, a moral premise. Thou shalt not murder. That is, thou shalt not kill innocent human beings. Nobody ever used to deny that. Now some people are, just to defend abortion. I'll tell you about that change in a minute. Second premise, from the moment of conception, that's a human being, a very small human being. Even though it's not capable of performing any distinctively human acts yet, a one-celled zygote doesn't have a human brain, but it's growing a human brain. If it was an ape, it would be growing an ape brain. If it was a bird, it would be growing a bird brain. There's no line of demarcation. There's no sudden stops between conception and natural death, not even birth. Birth is just getting a new address. Before Roe v. Wade, every science textbook, every biology textbook in the world said that with regard to any mammal, life begins, the life of any individual member of a mammalian species begins at the moment of conception. After Roe v. Wade, that sentence was struck from the books. Why? Was there any scientific evidence? Was there any new scientific discovery that justified striking that scientific fact from the books? No. It was no longer politically correct. All right, there's the second premise, the scientific premise. That which you abort is a human being. Third premise is the legal premise. Perhaps the most fundamental purpose of the law is to defend innocent human life. So if you don't know that, you don't know anything about law. And if you don't know when life begins, you don't know anything about biology. And if you don't know thou shalt not kill, you don't know anything about morality. Put those three premises together and you get the conclusion that it is morally outrageous that abortion is permitted. Now, I remember shortly after Roe v. Wade, a lot of philosophers weighed in on this issue, and always they attacked the biological premise. Nobody attacked the moral premise, thou shalt not kill innocent human beings. But they argued that's not a human being, it's a clump of cells, it's a potential human being. Well, if it's a potential human being, what is it actually? Is it a fish? Is it a frog? When does it become a human being? Now, I find that philosophers, pro-choice philosophers, are taking the opposite tack. They can't deny the scientific fact. So they deny the moral premise. Yeah, under some conditions, it is necessary to kill innocent human beings. Most philosophers are saying that now. Peter Singer, the most famous philosopher in the world, by the way, according to name recognition, is arguing explicitly for infanticide. Because it's ridiculous to think that you suddenly get a right to life when the moment that the two blades of the obstetrician's scissors meet and the umbilical cord is cut. And a second before that, you're not a human being, and a second after that, you are. That's the difference between abortion and infanticide. So he's arguing that all other products, he uses that word even, come with a 30-day guarantee. You can bring it back to the manufacturer if you're dissatisfied with it. We should treat our children in the same way. Okay to kill them for 30 days. I think he's expanded it to 60 now. When he first wrote an article justifying infanticide in the New York Times Sunday Supplement, New York Times likes to print controversial articles and invite readers' responses. Guess how many readers' responses there were? Zero. Here's the second argument. There are logically only two possibilities. Either that thing that you abort is a human being, or it isn't. And psychologically, there are only two possibilities. Either you know whether it's a human being or not, or you don't know. I'm not a legal expert, but I think that the Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, argued that, well, we really don't know whether it's a human being or not. Nobody knows when life begins. That is a mystery. All right, let's take that premise, which is false, and assume that it's true. Okay, you don't know whether that's a human being or not. Therefore, what should you do? When you don't know whether that thing in the road late at night under the overcoat, whether it's a human being or a coyote or a bunch of leaves, what do? Do you run over it or do you not? When you don't know whether there's anybody left in the building that's being evacuated because you're going to fumigate it with some deadly chemical that's going to kill all the bugs. When you don't know whether there's any human beings left in that building, do you fumigate it or do you not? When you don't know whether that movement in the leaves is a bear and you're out bear hunting, or whether that's your fellow hunter, do you shoot or do you not shoot? So when you don't know whether that thing in a woman's womb that you're about to kill, when you don't know whether that's a human being or not, what do? Do you shoot? Okay, let's look at the four possibilities. Possibility number one, it is a human being and you know it. Possibility number two, it is a human being and you don't know it. Possibility number three, it is not a human being and you know that. Possibility number four, it is not a human being and you do not know that. Those are the only four possibilities. What is abortion in each of these four cases? Well, in the first case, in which what you abort is a human being and you know that, that's murder. That's the definition of murder. Second possibility, it is a human being and you don't know that. Well, what's that? Well, it is a human being, but you didn't know it was a human being, so you didn't intend murder, but you shot in the bush and you fumigated the building and you ran over the overcoat and it was a human being. That's not murder, but that's homicide. You get in prison for that. Third possibility, it's not a human being, and you know that it is not a human being. In that case, abortion is fine. Just a clump of cells, fine, great, get rid of it. Fourth possibility, it is not a human being, but you don't know that. So you shoot in the bush and you fumigate the building and you run over the overcoat, not knowing whether it's a human being or not, and you're lucky it wasn't. What's that? That's criminal negligence. So the only one of the four possible cases in which abortion is morally permitted is the combination, it's not a human being, and you know that it's not a human being. I don't think there's any pro-choice people anymore who argue that you know for sure, for certain, that that's not a human being. So I think the argument from skepticism is much more convincing, or should be, to them, than the argument from we know that that's a human being. Almost every pro-choicer I have ever met or read says or assumes that we pro-lifers are dogmatic, that we're claiming to know too much, that we should be more open-minded and skeptical. And I reply, no, it's just the opposite. It's you who are dogmatic. Because the only justification for killing something is that you know for sure that it's not a human being. So if we don't know, don't shoot. Here's a third argument, very simple argument. It's from the Golden Rule. Golden Rule says, do unto others as you can consistently will others do to you. Don't lie because you don't want to be lied to. Don't steal because you don't want to be stolen from. Don't murder because you don't want to be murdered. And since we're all former fetuses, if we had any choice in the matter, would we choose to live or die? Well, just look at what a fetus does when you go after it. Look at how it runs away. In a sense, it's more intelligent than you are. It knows the difference between life and death, and it's choosing life. It's trying to. And you're imposing death upon it. If you gave it equal rights, which is what the Golden Rule says you should do, you should equip every fetus with a suction tube or a poison something or other, or maybe a set of forceps to come at the abortionists, make it a fair fight. How many abortions would there be then? Finally, a fourth argument is there's two philosophies about humanity. One philosophy says that all human beings are persons. The other says that only some are persons. And most pro-choicers argue that way. They say, legally, you can't assume that all human beings are persons. Person is a legal term. And the law sets a boundary around persons. The law defines what it is to be a person. A person is somebody with legal rights. Well, okay, there's two philosophies. One says that all human beings are persons, and the other says that only some are persons. Who believed and practiced the second philosophy, that only some human beings are persons? Well, the Nazis. Jews were not persons. Why? The law said so. The masters of black slaves, justified again by our wonderful Supreme Court, by the Dred Scott decision, which said black people aren't fully people, they're six-tenths people. Whenever you want to kill somebody, you have to depersonalize them first. Because we've got enough moral sense to say killing innocent human persons is a bad thing to do. So even though they're biologically human, they're not persons. Why? Because we say so. Very, very dangerous philosophy. Of course, that's another name for that is moral relativism, or moral subjectivism. And it is now ensconced in Supreme Court law. In the 1992 Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision, Justice Anthony Kennedy, in the famous mystery passage, you know, among at the heart of liberty, there is the right to decide for yourself the meaning of life and the mystery of human existence. In other words, God, move over, you're in my seat. So you have a choice. Pro-life people are indeed pro-choice because they get pro-life from Moses, whose great sermon to the chosen people, which was to carry them through their history, was choose, but choose life. That's what we want. That's why I think rational persuasion and convincing people is much more effective and will eventually work much better than simple legal force. I know the law has to use force, it has to deter crimes, but if most people don't believe in a law, it's going to be changed. So you have to change people's hearts and minds first. Education. So what do we do? Well, we speak, but what acts must we do? Oh, okay, well, I'm not going to give you anything new here. I may have clarified a little bit, because I teach logic, what the arguments were in the last few minutes, but I'm not going to say anything you don't all know. I'm not going to surprise you at all in my answer to this question. What acts do you do? Number one, love. Love everybody. Love has to be the motive for everything you do. That's very easy to know, very hard to do. Examine your motives, and you'll find that most of our motives are mixed. A saint is somebody who has agape love, unselfish love, honest love, as his 100% motive for absolutely everything he does. Let's work on that. Second thing you have to do is pray. Because it's God who's going to end abortion. God is going to change hearts. But he's going to do it when we put enough pressure on him. Jesus is very, very pragmatic. He says, in some way, God is like this unjust judge. And there's this old lady who's a bother, and she kept banging on his door. Give me justice, give me justice. He doesn't want to give her justice. Eventually, if she keeps banging enough, he'll do it. My father's like that. Be the little old lady. And ask him what you can do. Different people do different things. Everybody's got talents. Everybody's very good at something and very bad at something else. I never met any human being who was good at everything. I never met a human being who was terrible at everything. All right, so you think and speak, you love, you pray, you ask God what to do, he tells you, and then what do? You do it. I will tell you right now the most brilliant idea that ever occurred to my mind. I was 8 years old. We were driving home from church, my father, my mother, and I. I know exactly where we were, in the car, in Haledon, New Jersey. And I had just come out of Sunday school, and I was kind of confused about it. And I said to my father, Dad, all this stuff we learn in church and Sunday school, it's really only one thing, isn't it? And he looked at me and said, no, it's a lot of things. What do you mean, one thing? He was sort of puzzled. I said, well, I mean, we just have to ask God what to do, and then we just have to do it, right? And I saw his face change. He had a big smile. He said, son, you're right. You're absolutely right. Well, it's been all downhill since then. Be simple-minded like Mother Teresa. Nobody ever won an argument against Mother Teresa. She's too simple for that. Too many people? That's like too many flowers. How can you argue with that? One of the most brilliant intellectuals of the 20th century, Malcolm Muggeridge, the former editor of Punch magazine, very funny British magazine, an atheist or an agnostic for most of his life, became a Christian, but not a Catholic. He made Mother Teresa famous, so he became her close friend. And she kept saying, how come you don't go all the way? And he gave answers, and one day they were walking around her hospital, and she said, Malcolm, you're a good man. How come you don't see your way all the way into the Catholic Church? And Malcolm said, this is in his autobiography, he said, I replied to Mother Teresa, well, Mother, I guess I will answer you in your own words. I guess God sees that Malcolm Muggeridge is a good man, and God needs some good men outside the Catholic Church, too. And then Mother Teresa gave me three words, and because of those three words, I couldn't not become a Catholic. The words were, no, he doesn't. Be that simple. But also, be cheerful. When I started reading more stuff about Mother Teresa, who's an absolutely amazing person, the thing that surprised me the most was how cheerful she was, and she insisted that her nuns constantly be cheerful. Not just pretend to be, but really be cheerful. Because joy is one of the fruits of the Holy Spirit. If you've got the Holy Spirit, you'll have joy, no matter what. And then, after her death, came out this fact that she probably had the longest dark night of the soul that any human being in the history of the world ever had. Most of her life, she felt the presence of God about as much as Jesus felt him on the cross when he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And this was one of the most cheerful women who ever lived. The smiles in those wrinkles were amazing. I met her once. She came to my hometown, Newton. And she just shook people's hands and said hello very briefly outside the church. And I just shook her hand, and I said hello, and she had said hello, nothing else. Oh, God bless you. And I didn't see a halo around her head or anything. She was perfectly grandmotherly, but I was the only person in the world for her. And I think people that met Jesus felt that. He's not proportioning his time. He's not proportioning his attention. He's not proportioning his love. He's giving everything at this moment to me alone. You know, in Catholic theology, the precious blood is infinitely powerful. So one drop of his blood would have saved the world, would have been sufficient to redeem the world from sin. So he could have redeemed the world just by his circumcision. Why did he give 12 pints of blood on the cross? And the answer is because he had 12 pints to give. That's what love does. We have to show that as well as tell it. And we have to show it with joy, with cheerfulness. We have to show that life is joy. People who want to abort their babies do not believe that life is joy. They believe that with that baby, life would be misery. Not all human lives are joys. We have to show them that's not true. It's show and tell. It's St. Francis of Assisi's gospel. Preach the gospel, use words when necessary. That's going to work. I don't know how long it'll take or how much the body count will be, but we're going to win that war. Saints won the world. You can't argue with a saint. Saints converted the hard-nosed Roman Empire. It happened once. It's going to happen again. Well, that's all I have to say, but I hope you have a lot of questions.
Open for questions?
By the way, I find that Catholic audiences are usually very patient, even during dull, absent-minded professor-type talks, because they believe in purgatory. So they're waiting to get to heaven. The Q&A session is always more heavenly, more interesting than the monologue.
I had a question about Peter Singer. It just amazes me that he can expound the things that he does, especially because his parents, he wouldn't exist if his parents hadn't escaped from the Nazis.
And someone once asked him, you spent a lot of money to put your mother in a specialty Alzheimer's nursing home, and yet you argue that we shouldn't treat our parents with any preferential love and treat all people equally. And he replied, yes, I feel very guilty about that.
I was wondering if he ever talked about, he has to have been criticized for the similarity between his point of view and the plan that the Nazis came up with, killing disabled children.
Yeah.
And does he ever refer to his background with that?
I don't know. I do remember being at a philosophy convention. I was persuaded to give a paper. I don't usually do that sort of thing. And I had some extra time. And one of his disciples, a woman, I forget her name, she's pretty famous, was giving a talk on active euthanasia and defending it. And there were about 50 people in the audience, and he concluded the talk, I heard the last half of it, by saying, look how we treat members of other species, mice, for instance. We classify them into three groups. Some of them we find improve our lives. We call them pets, and we take care of them. Some of them disturb our lives. We call them pests, and we set traps for them. Others neither help our lives nor hinder our lives. They're just field mice, and we ignore them, and we let them live. I see absolutely no reason whatsoever, other than sentimentality, for not treating members of our own species in exactly the same way. Only one person in the audience went, she was an Irish lady, very Irish. She had a baby. Nobody else, the other 49 people, sort of nodded their heads. Well, of course. Father Kotersky, a great Jesuit moral theologian from Fordham, was one of the people that was supposed to respond to the paper. He just gave up. He said, with this audience, I cannot say anything that you would find meaningful. Just gave up. Now, that's not typical. That's philosophers. I mean, philosophers are insane. And yet, even those people that were not shocked by that have instincts. They're suppressing their instincts. And my first point, appeal to those instincts which have got to be down there somewhere. They're human beings. They may not think that unborn babies are human beings, but they're human beings. So deep down they know that. Yeah, the problem with Peter Singer is that he's not a singer. He's too serious. Life is not a song for him. More questions? Oh, come on, there's got to be questions. I'll threaten you with a lecture. Now, I'll give you one of my favorite anecdotes from Lives of the Great Philosophers by the Roman gossip columnist Diogenes Laertius. He said once Aristotle was lecturing to his class in the world's second university, the Lyceum, which he set up after Plato died, because he loved Plato so much, and he taught an alternative philosophy to Plato's, but he was still so close to Plato that, like Plato, he admired and idealized Socrates, and he expected Socratic dialogue after every lecture. In fact, he was called the Peripatetic, which means in Greek, the one who walks around, because he used to have Socratic dialogues with his disciples as they were walking around in circles in his school. And after this one lecture, there were no questions for the first time in a long while. He was deeply disappointed. So he said, if you were listening, my lecture was on levels of intelligence in the universe. And according to my philosophy, there are three. There is the intelligence of the gods, there is the intelligence of human beings, and there is the intelligence of animals. And I also said that you could empirically tell the difference between human intelligence and the other two by the very same factor. Humans ask questions. Gods do not ask questions because they know all the answers already. Animals don't ask questions because they're not intelligent enough to even ask a question. And therefore, if you have no questions, shall I congratulate you upon having risen to the status of the gods, or shall I insult you upon having sunk to the level of the beasts? And the last line of the little story was, and after that there were questions. Now, having insulted you, I expect that there are some questions.
My question is about people who may know the facts, but who just don't care. So somebody who says, you know, I realize that it might be, the fetus might be a human being, or that I may not know, but I really don't care. I just want to get rid of it.
Don't believe them. Deep down they care. It's an issue. I don't think anybody treats abortion in the same way that they treat a hangnail. It's impossible. Don't believe them. Speak to the person inside.
What about people? I've heard women say, I would never do it, but I think it's okay for others to choose.
Ah, well, that's an argument. And that's like saying, well, I don't believe in rape myself, but I wouldn't want to stop other people from doing it. And I wouldn't have a slave myself, but I don't want to outlaw slavery. And I wouldn't think of putting Jews in a gas chamber, but, you know, let's be tolerant and pluralistic. By the way, do you know who manufactures RU486, the abortion drug? After World War II, IG Farben, that manufactured Zyklon B, the gas that they used in Auschwitz, was discontinued and broken up. And it was reconstituted as Höchste Uklaff, an international company. They manufacture RU486. They're in the same business still.
Professor, you alluded to the fact that another life issue that's emerged a lot in recent years is assisted suicide and euthanasia. Yeah. I'm wondering if you could apply some of the things you've said to those issues as well.
Well, assisted suicide is something like transgenderism, because there's a conflict in both cases between thought and biology, between the mind and the body. Your body tells you you're a man, and you say, I want to be a woman, so I am a woman, so I can go into a lady's bathroom. And your body tells you, I want to live, and your mind tells you, I don't want to live. That's why you won't commit suicide. So even when your mind tells you, I don't want to live, your body still tells you, I do. So we can deal with that problem either on the bodily level or on the mental level. So we can either send people, including children now, to surgeons to mutilate their sexual organs because we trust their thoughts more than their bodies, or the opposite. Similarly, we can either say, well, you are of sound mind, so we'll give you what you want, we'll kill you. Or we can say, you still have a body that is alive, and you're not accepting that fact, so let's talk about it. Let's treat you in the mind. Depends on how high a view you have of the wisdom of the body. And if, as is increasingly the case in our culture, if the sexual revolution has pretty much destroyed the notion of the body as something good and holy and wise and has reduced it to a machine, an instrument for pleasure, then that's going to work in assisted suicide and transgenderism too. So we've got to reverse that notion of the body. What is your body? Is that you? Or is that a thing that you're manipulating? Are you a ghost, and is your body a house, and so you're a haunted house? Is your body a machine, and your mind is the ghost in the machine? How does the mind operate that machine? How can ghostly fingers push the buttons of that machine? Isn't the body itself wise? Is it just the brain that's thinking? The whole body's thinking. The nervous system is thinking. Biofeedback. There's immense scientific evidence that the body is, the whole body is not distinct from the soul as a separate substance. The psychosomatic unity is blindingly obvious. The soul is related to the body in the same way as the meaning of a book is related to the words of a book. So I think most people who want either a transgender surgical operation or suicide see their minds and their bodies as totally, radically different things. They trust their minds instead of their bodies. Now, I don't have a brilliant, clever, original, infallibly guaranteed psychiatric cure for that ill, but I think that's the ill.
Professor, I was wondering, I imagine that Boston College is like many of our institutions, or many folks we know, or I guess sometimes how we are, where in name we're Catholic, and but when it comes to what the Catholic Church believes, we may not always live up to that or even agree to that. And I was just curious, in your experience at Boston College, how have you interacted with folks who may be carrying the Catholic name, but maybe disagree with things that, by definition, mm-hmm. the Catholic Church is. Do you have any tips or thoughts on that?
Well, BC has the right letters. It stands for barely Catholic. No, you can still get a first-rate Catholic education at Boston College if you know what professors to take and what courses to take and what student groups to hang around with. You can also get horribly lost. So depending on how well-educated and how strong a faith your kid is, if you're thinking of sending him to Boston College, it might be a good choice. It's expensive, but it's a darn good school.
How do you interact with your
professors? Well, the philosophy department is great, academically and religiously. There's one atheist, one semi-Marxist, and one deconstructionist, and one sort of nothing, and the other 20 out of 24 are practicing Catholics. It's a great department, and we respect each other. And the theologians in the theology department are mostly heretics, but they're nice people. I mean, they're so open-minded, their brains fell out. And they're so tolerant, they'd invite a Satanist there. Actually, the chairman of the theology department 10 years ago was an atheist. An atheist teaching theology. That's like a Buddhist teaching physics. You know, Buddhists don't believe matter exists. Well, why would they teach physics? If you believe God exists, if it doesn't exist, or if you're an atheist, why do you teach theology? There are some good theologians left. The most Catholic theologian at BC is a Lutheran. That's not a joke, it's true. But BC has some good departments and some good professors, and I love it. There's a good feeling there. There's not a lot of nastiness and argumentation, maybe within the theology department, but not really in the university as a whole, not that much. It's becoming more and more typical, unfortunately, and it's idolizing its reputation in U.S. News and World Report, and it's de-emphasizing the humanities and emphasizing the sciences because that's where the money is, but almost everybody's doing that nowadays. But it hasn't, it's nowhere near as far down the road as Georgetown. Here's Georgetown, here's BC and Notre Dame, both good schools. Here's Steubenville and Ave Maria and Thomas Aquinas College and you know, really Catholic colleges. It's halfway in between. And by the way, it's a university, not a seminary, so I don't think we should be that shocked at the fact that some of the professors are atheists and some of the invited speakers are anti-Catholic. That's what a university is for, debate. But the university's own stated principles and positions ought to be authentically Catholic. And therefore, they should have truth in labeling. That's the problem.
I'm not sure what the exact question is here, but when he brought up the euthanasia and in the conversation, it struck something for me working in the hospital. If we have someone who comes in and they tried to commit suicide, we put them on a 72-hour hold.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot leave the hospital. You are a danger to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have these conversations about euthanasia, where we have someone who is very aware of their medical condition and has very consciously chosen to not make healthy choices for themselves. And yet we pour thousands of dollars of resource and hours and time and care into trying to uphold that life.
Mm-hmm.
I feel such a contradiction in that it I don't know if I question that, but it brought rise to something.
We don't think with our minds, we think with our passions, and therefore we think in contradictory ways. 2/3 of American people, according to the polls, ever since Roe v. Wade, have believed that abortion ought to be legal. 2/3 of the American people believe that the fetus is a human being, and therefore abortion is murder. 2/3 of the people believe that murder should not be legal. Go figure. Well, the head can only go so far. It's only a part. But at least you're not Oregon yet, right? This is still Minnesota, right?
So what do you say to people who use the argument that it is unsafe for women in this country if abortion is not legal? What would happen with them and infection rate and rates of abortion? Would it actually change?
Well, that's a serious problem for strategy. And if nothing else being changed, due to the next election, it would be possible to suddenly enact a law making illegal all abortions in America suddenly, I would not be in favor of that. because it would do more harm than good in the long run. The reaction against it would be so bad, because the educational program that's necessary to justify such a change is not yet in place. So that's a legitimate question. What would happen if? But you can't make moral decisions based on that question. You can make prudential decisions based on that question. But whether abortion is good or bad doesn't depend on consequences. That's utilitarianism. That's the end justifies the means. If you don't have principles and only have consequences, that's not really morality. That's like doing arithmetic without ever learning the principles. You can't do it. It's something else, it's guesswork. So what justifies or unjustifies abortion is not what would happen if, it's not the consequences, it's what abortion is, essentially. Because the consequences can change. In a morally educated public, the consequences of outlawing abortion would be very different than the consequences of outlawing abortion in present-day America. And that's a relevant consideration. But that doesn't say abortion is okay or it's not okay. What makes a thing okay or not okay is simply what it is. And unfortunately, people don't ask that question anymore. They're skeptics. Well, we can't know what things are. We just know how we feel about them and what's going to happen. So we've got to get them to ask that question. What is it? What's going on there? What is the thing that you're aborting? That's the question everybody wants to avoid on the pro-choice side, because the evidence is unambiguous that the answer to that question is that is a very small human being.
Hello. Last summer, I worked with this organization called Little Sisters of the Poor, and as you know, they have their Supreme Court cases, and I've been trying to understand that, but if you could shed some light on what is happening with the case with the Little Sisters of the Poor and what that might mean for other Catholic organizations.
Well, I don't understand what the settlement was. I know it's some sort of compromise. And when a moral principle is at work, compromise isn't usually the right answer. We're not as far advanced as Canada or Western Europe yet, where hate crimes are just thought crimes. There was a couple in England about 10 years ago that used to take in a lot of foster children. They were a very successful, very loving couple. The foster children improved a lot under their care. And a number of these foster children were gay, and they were treated the same as anyone else, loved and cared for. The government ran a survey of foster parents, and one of the questions on the survey was, what are your religious beliefs? And these were evangelical Protestant Christians, and they answered, well, our beliefs are everything in the Bible. And then the government said, well, do you believe what the Bible says about homosexuality? And they said, yes, we do. And then the answer was, well, if you believe that, you can't have foster children anymore. Now, there's a fundamental line that's crossed. You're persecuted not for what you do or what you don't do, but for what you believe. And the government has the right to put you in an inquisition and force you to tell you what they believe. And if what you believe is the Bible, you're illegal. In Canada, it is illegal to speak in public certain verses from the Bible, especially from Leviticus. There was a Protestant preacher in Sweden who was jailed for a little while for preaching a sermon in his private church on Leviticus, but a government spy was in the audience and recorded the sermon. It was hate speech. It was against homosexuality. So, private speech and private opinions, at least in Europe, and I think in Canada too, are now being targeted. That is a fundamental line that's being crossed. That's the difference between Machiavelli and Rousseau. Machiavelli is simply a totalitarian by force. Rousseau is a totalitarian by thought. In Rousseau's world, the general will is infallible, and you simply cannot think differently than everybody thinks. It's intolerable. You know, complete tyrants, consistent tyrants, they are not satisfied with changing your behavior. They have to change your thoughts.
The pro-life movement, we hear lots about euthanasia, obviously against abortion. How do we help people that truly believe in the pro-life way of life to understand that life begins prior to the beginning of life with their choice of using contraception or learning a natural family planning method? It seems like a lot of pro-life people don't see that link between the use of artificial contraception and how that has just kind of taken us down the path towards the culture of death.
Well, the issues are not the same. Contraception is not murder, abortion is, but they're certainly related because abortion is backup contraception. The only reason any woman wants abortion is that her contraception failed. So that's definitely a connection. So what do we do about it? We talk. We argue. We ask questions. We use the Socratic method. We pull the other person's ideas out of them. What do you believe and why? Maybe I don't understand you. Let me listen a while. And if you listen to them, then maybe they'll listen to you. But the argument is basically the same. Here is a human life, and this is something that is intrinsically valuable. It's not an instrument, it's not a means, it's not a machine, it's not something that exists for my convenience or my pleasure, it exists for its own sake. Most people can understand that. But if you preach at them without listening to them first, they're probably going to just get their hackles up. And even that can't do much harm. Upset them a little bit, fine, Jesus did that. But I think the best method is to be Socratic. Ask them leading questions. And mean it. You have to understand your patient if you're a psychiatrist, and you have to understand your patient's body if you're in medicine. So we have to understand people's morality if we're going to argue morality. So we have to listen. So we need moral and philosophical stethoscopes.
I'm going to, the evening's coming to a late time, Cyril. I'm going to end the questions here now. I want to thank Dr. Kraft for this talk tonight. I thank all of you for attending, and hope to see you again next year. I wonder, Bishop, would you lead us in prayer at the end, please? Oh, yeah, don't forget about the talk. My wife reminds me, good thing I have her here. There is a talk tomorrow at 9 a.m. in the basement of the church, of the cathedral. Why be Catholic?
And all the men, listen to your wives. My wife is right. I did fall off the stage once.